90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings, everyone. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, October 11th, 2009. I'm beautiful. Urbana's WILLAM 580. We have a great show for you today, an all-time first in Media Matters history. Two guests, not one, sequential. We'll be going to some documentary filmmakers. First, Michael Moore, who will be joining us first, and then we're going to move on the second half of the hour to discussion with Sue Wilson of her brand new documentary. But before we go to Sue Wilson and Michael Moore, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. The Federal Communications Commission has announced plans to create stronger open internet rules. And the fight over network neutrality, the longstanding principle that keeps information flowing freely online, has been reignited, with opponents of net neutrality increasingly resorting to misinformation and spin. To counter those arguments from big phone and cable companies and their hired front groups, Free Press has released a new report called Digital Deja Vu, Old Myths About Net Neutrality. It exposes false claims net neutrality opponents are making about investment, regulation, competition, and other prevalent issues. Derek Turner is the research director of Free Press.
The reason we wrote this paper was to alert people in the debate that a lot of the talking points coming out against net neutrality are simply old and long discredited talking points, that this ground was tread years ago when the net neutrality debate first started in 2005 and 2006, and even the providers themselves have moved on from some of these arguments.
With phony grassroots groups and industry lobbyists smearing net neutrality on the airwaves, on the internet, and in newspaper op-ed pieces, Turner wanted to set the record straight.
The sky is not falling. We're not talking about some type of radical, new, heavy-handed regulation of the internet. What we're talking about is preserving something that's always existed, which is basic rules of the road that prevent incumbent internet service providers from discriminating. These aren't new regulations. In fact, the internet was born under a regime of non-discriminatory protections. The internet as we know it today wouldn't exist if it wasn't for regulation.
If the internet is not protected, users will begin to see changes in the way their connections work. Turner says that without net neutrality, peer-to-peer file sharing will be a thing of the past. Telephone applications like Skype will slow to a crawl or disappear, and your favorite sites may load very slowly or not at all. Laptops could be locked down, much like mobile phones are today. They'll come preloaded with software that only works on one network, that will only access certain sites.
These carriers' mindset is so backward and so closed, and so focused on monetizing everything that flows across their network, that they think that's what consumers want, and that's certainly what they want because it helps prop up their stock price. They're very short-term focused, and they don't see the bigger picture. They don't see that an open internet with unlimited applications and that's evolving at a rapid pace is actually good for their own businesses. It makes consumers value the connections more. It gets more people on the network, and it actually makes them a ton of money.
To read Digital Deja Vu, go to freepress.net.
Last week at the museum in Washington, D.C., the Knight Commission on the Information Needs of Communities in a Democracy released an extensive new report on the information needs of citizens in the 21st century. Informing communities, sustaining democracy in the digital age was the product of 18 months of work and numerous hearings, panels, and interviews. The Knight Commission included 17 commissioners from diverse backgrounds and across the political spectrum. Commission co-chair Theodore Olson, the former U.S. Solicitor General, expressed how inspired he was by the creativity and innovation that is taking place every day.
We put a lot of attention into the fact, what do communities need? What is the array of things that communities can use to judge themselves? Those community citizens in those communities can judge how their communities are doing to evaluate the access to information and how it gets to them and what types of information and what channels of communication they need so that they can put pressure on the leaders of their community to do something about it.
Former FCC Chairman Michael Powell said that democracy is organized around geography. In this age of virtual reality and distance overcome by digital technology, we often overlook the significance of physical surroundings, our roads, schools, local economies, and community centers.
There's two kinds of information. We focused on both what you need to be a civic participant in order to be an active member and in a vibrant democracy, but we also understand there's no way to do that if the personal life-enhancing needs that you need on a day-to-day basis, when my family wakes up at 6 o'clock, what does it have to know at 6:01 and moving forward?
The commission proposed three basic steps for creating a stronger information system. First, the creation of universal broadband access for all Americans through a national digital broadband infrastructure. Second, the creation of a national policy to help people engage with the information and use it to help build stronger communities. And third, finding sustainable models for supporting the kind of journalism that informs Americans of the world they are living in. To read the report, Informing Communities, go to nightcom.org. That's KNIGHTCOMM.org. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here in WILL AM 580. We have a live show for you today, but the first segment is recorded. The next 22 minutes is an interview I conducted with Michael Moore just a little over a week ago. It was our chance to speak with Michael Moore about his new film, Capitalism, A Love Story, and other issues. So don't call in asking to speak with Michael Moore. He did promise at the end of the show to come back live in the future when the movie publicity tour is over. But for the time being, enjoy the next 22 minutes. Then we will be back live at the bottom of the hour at 1:30 with Sue Wilson to discuss her documentary on broadcast news, Broadcast Blues. But until then, enjoy the Michael Moore interview, and I'll be back with you in 22 minutes. Michael?
Hi there.
Hey, Michael Moore. Bob McChesney here. Welcome to Media Matters on WILL AM 580, the NPR affiliate in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me on, and thanks for all the good work you do. I follow it closely and support you from afar.
Well, I really appreciate that. You know, one of the things that's striking about all your films, and this one I think is no different, and I confess I've yet to see this one, though I'm going to see it this weekend, is... That you cover stories that our news media ought to be covering. I mean, it's like you're a reporter in a way on stuff. When you're done with the film, you're wondering, why didn't I know this? Why wasn't this being covered in our news media? And it strikes me offhand that this current film, Capitalism, a Love Story, that's even more true, that this is a story that is in a lot of ways about a media system that failed us.
Oh, I think that's very true. And I, the people that have seen the movie already, one of the main comments I get from people after the movie is, how come they didn't show us that on the nightly news?
Mm-hmm.
They must have had that. And I said, oh, yeah, no, they did have it, because I found it in their archives. there's one particular scene of Don Regan, who was Ronald Reagan's chief of staff, essentially not knowing his microphone was on, telling Reagan what to do. And you can see very clearly who's in charge. And not many people, you know, it wasn't really pointed out much at the time, just where Don Regan came from. People listening may not even remember, but
mm-hmm.
He was the chairman of Merrill Lynch. At that time, was the largest investment firm there in Wall Street. And it was really the beginnings of direct involvement of Wall Street bankers in the White House running the show. And that has continued now through the last number of administrations, both Democratic and Republican. And it's at a point now where their purpose of being there, their purpose of essentially running the economy, is to protect the wealthiest 1% who currently have more financial wealth in this country than the bottom 95% combined. That's where we're at right now.
You know, Michael Moore, it one of the striking things about all the media you've been doing for this movie, for Capitalism, a Love Story, and the movie itself, is that you boldly say it's time to get rid of capitalism, that it has failed us, that it's no longer a productive system. And this is a pretty striking comment, because I think 10 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe even now, you know, it's really, we haven't heard someone say something like this for at least a generation in the United States. Do you think the time is right for this discussion?
Oh, I can see that it's right. I mean, I'm saying it on, you know, on Jay Leno.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying it on Good Morning America, and I'm the response. You know, I think it's because, well, first of all, I guess we have Joe the Plumber to thank for this. The words capitalism and socialism really haven't been part of the public discourse for some time. You just, in normal, polite conversation, you just never heard the words.
Mm-hmm.
And then Barack Obama's campaigning on a suburban Toledo street, and there's this guy, Joe, the plumber, and Barack Obama says to him, you know, I think we need to spread the wealth around a little bit. And that just blew it open. They started calling him a socialist. A lot of young people had never really heard that term before, and they started thinking, well, what's that all about?
Mm-hmm.
You do a little investigation, and you hear, well, it's really, you know, it's kind of about making sure everybody is, you know, gets a fair slice of the pie. And, you know, to someone who hasn't been, especially a young person who hasn't been, you know, had to go through the Cold War era and all the Red Scare and everything, that doesn't sound like such a bad thing to them. And in fact, the Rasmussen poll at election time, after calling Barack Obama a socialist for 2 or 3 months, they did a poll of young adults, and they found that that capitalism was favored by young adults over socialism by only 4 percentage points, more than socialism.
That's actually extraordinary, considering socialism hasn't had a lot of publicity on its behalf in our country.
And then, of course, a month after Joe the Plumber, the crash happened. So then President Bush starts making all these speeches defending capitalism. And again, you never heard a president of the United States say, my fellow Americans, today's topic is capitalism. You know, they never even use the word. You know, they talk about free enterprise, free market, and all that, but you never really, that word wasn't used very much. So in the last year, permission was given, I guess, to use these words. And I was already making the film when the crash happened, and I thought, well, this is actually good. This is bad for a lot of people in terms of the crash, but it's going to allow us now to walk through a door that has been shut for a long time, and that's to question the very system itself. And, while I was making the film, I thought, well, you know, people are really going to get into this long before the film comes out. And I have to say that here we are more than a year after the crash, and I don't know about you, but, I mean, I read a lot of op-ed pages, and I watch the cable talk shows, and they've dissected this bailout and the crash and come at it from every different angle and every different thing about it. I've never heard anybody allowed on TV or on the op-ed pages just state what I think is the obvious and just go right to the core of the problem, that maybe what's wrong here is capitalism itself. Why isn't that part of the discussion? Why isn't that allowed? And so I figured, well, you know, that's when I decided I'm just going to put the word right in the title of the movie, and I'm going to go for it here, and let's get this discussion going.
Yeah, thanks for doing that. It took a lot of courage, and it really is the discussion we need to be having. I know you don't have a lot of time. I want to go back to the media for a second. We had Wendell Potter, the Cigna Insurance sort of former executive, has come out as a main advocate of healthcare reform in the United States. And one of his last jobs at Cigna was shooting down your last film, Sicko. And he said, you know, that he watched the film and they checked it, and it checked out completely. It was completely factually accurate. You nailed the story perfectly in Sicko. And that was one of the reasons he left that job and went to the other side when he realized what he was doing. And what's striking to me is when you're on these shows with Wolf Blitzer or all these mainstream media, you've got these movies that are fact-checked, you know, 42 times over. And they question you like you're pulling it out of the air. And then they've got the birthers, the deathers, these lunatics pushing off these crazy theories that are taken seriously. Does that make you go insane at times?
Yes. I spent so much time. I have such a great research staff. I have probably upwards of a dozen people, researchers, lawyers, fact-checkers. In the past, I've hired the former fact-checkers from the New Yorker magazine who are known for, you know, their diligence. I'm very, very not just careful, but I really want because I want people to hear the argument I'm going to make. I need them to know that the facts are always, always correct. And yet I get put through a ringer, as you mentioned. But hearing Wendell Potter's story when he first went on Bill Moyers a couple months ago to reveal this, and I had never met the guy, but apparently he had met me because he and the other health insurance people, they all, the different companies, got together to figure out how to smear me and Sicko, and he was assigned to go to the premiere of it in Michigan, in the town where I live, and watch the film. And as you said, as he's watching it, he's seeing that, oh my God, this is all true. And he brought his 14-year-old son with him, and he tells the story of how at the end of the movie, after his son has just watched essentially what his dad does for a living, which is to participate in a system that denies care for people and causes the deaths of at least 18,000 people a year simply because they can't get insured. At the end of the movie, his 14-year-old son gets up out of his seat and runs to me and wants my autograph, wants to get a picture with me, and he's watching his son, Michael Moore, as his hero, and he's crushed by this. And it really was his St. Paul moment. He was knocked off his horse, essentially, on the road to Damascus. And from that point on, I think, you know, he decided that he could no longer live life like that. And the documents that he's provided, Bob, that have shown not only how the health insurance industry concocts all these lies about universal health care and about what how they do it in other countries, but in my specific case, they put together the list of journalists who they believe would be most responsive to their talking points. And they hit these people up. And then they decided that each of them from the different health insurance companies would call and badger all the film critics to try and spin them against the film before they even saw the film. Mm-hmm. So now that I've been on this media tour for Capitalism, A Love Story, I'm running into all these film critics who I haven't seen in a couple of years, and they're telling me it's all true, that before they even had a chance to watch Sicko, they were getting calls from this health insurance company, this pharmaceutical company, just trying to really prime the pump to get them to write a negative review about Sicko. It's just been an amazing thing to witness how much time, effort, and money is spent by these companies to spin the public toward things that aren't true. And in this case, Bob, I mean, this was just a movie. They were that afraid of a movie to spend that much time and money. Yeah. It actually, in some ways, encouraged me to just keep doing this because, you know, they talk about the power of cinema, and I'm thinking, wow, well, I guess maybe that is true. Maybe there is some power here. That if they think a movie is going to could possibly be a tipping point, so here we are now with this film, and I await the backlash and the spin and the propaganda.
I know that your publicist said we only had a short period. Do you have time for one more question?
Oh, of course. First of all, I don't have a publicist.
That's okay.
The person from the Hollywood studio.
Okay.
That's telling you that.
Okay.
So you take as much time as you want.
Oh, that's what I'd like to hear. You know, one of the other words that's come up in your talks, in your interview with Naomi Klein that was published in The Nation, is a word that also we haven't heard in America in a long time, at least in a serious way, not in a rhetorical way, which is the word fascism. And you were talking about what's going on the far right in this country now with the discontent in society, but also with, you know, the bizarro irrationalism that's going on the far right that's sort of unhinged at this point in time. How's that connected to what you're talking about in Capitalism, A Love Story?
Well, I think it's historically, I mean, the right wing has, not just in this country, obviously, but certainly in other countries we know of, has taken advantage of those times when people are hurting, when they've lost their jobs, when they're being thrown out of their homes. And they are very good at whipping up a lot of fear and a lot of scapegoating. And they understand that dark side of our human nature, where we will respond to that in a time when our life is full of deep, deep despair. And, you know, I guess, you know, instead of bemoaning, you know, how they pack those town hall meetings and these teabag parties and all that, I think that people on the other side of the political fence have to say, look, we're the majority. The majority of Americans voted for Barack Obama. The majority, vast majority of both houses of Congress to not be in Republican hands. You know, people have to get off the bench here and have their voices heard. They can't just sit by and watch this happen, because it will happen, and a minority will control this. A minority of right-wing voices will control this debate if the majority doesn't get up and get active and be heard. And I can't stress that enough. Every day people should be thinking about, who am I calling today? Who am I sending an email to today? Is there something we can do here locally? Can we organize? Can we be visible? What is it we need to do? And we have to be relentless about this, because trust me, the other side, they are relentless. And they are committed, and they will not give up.
You know, Michael Moore, you know, you and I are roughly the same age. We've had similar political and experiences, although a great deal more success in your part. But the point being that
well, that's not true. But I wouldn't. I mean, success. That's just
or prominence, I should say.
What you have done, and what Media Matters provided such an invaluable resource to so many people out there. You know, I get the emails, you know, and even though, I mean, you and I don't have any kind of a personal connection, but as I told you at the beginning here, that thank God that you exist and that I get this information that I otherwise wouldn't have, and I'm able to share that information with others, and so many people do that, and so this work is all very important. Each of us play a role in this. Each of us have a piece of this to really try and turn things around and make things better in this country.
Well, that's kind of, I actually wasn't fishing for that compliment, but I'm certainly going to take it. The point I was trying to make, though, was that, you know, you and I came through a period in which we grew up in the late 60s and 70s and came of age, and then this country went way to the right, and I think progressive forces have been pretty much on the defensive for most of our lifetimes. And it seems like things in the last few years are really changing, you know, that there's the forces of progress are realigning. Is that your sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's a lot less defense being played today and much more offense, and that certainly is why, you know, things changed last November, certainly. But I think, you know, what it is, too, I think that a younger generation has come up. A lot of them are the kids that we raised. And they see very clearly what's going on. I mean, Obama's election was ignited by really young people. Young people drove that, especially in the early primaries. Young people made that happen. And as the old and the old ways die off, things do change. Things do get better. Racism does dissipate somewhat because, you know, I mean, I don't want to say this in the wrong way, but, you know, older people who had the old values of old America, especially when it came to race, you know, anybody who was 60 years old when Ronald Reagan was elected is dead now. Mm-hmm. Anybody 60 or older, I mean, there's a few that would be alive. They'd be in their 90s.
Yeah.
But essentially, that kind of thinking went with them. And as younger people became adults, they didn't have those feelings about race and other matters. And so that's been for the good. And it really, historically, isn't that really how things happen, that as rotten as things are throughout the ages, it incrementally does get better with certain setbacks. You know, sometimes mm-hmm. it's you know, two steps forward and one step backward.
But it always is.
It always moves forward. So I'm essentially an optimist.
How concerned are you, especially with the movie Capitalism: A Love Story, when you've got, like, my daughter is 21 and her friends and the students I teach, many of whom were enthusiastic about Obama and all their friends were, and they really envisioned sort of although they wouldn't use these terms, but I think a sort of a new deal of real fundamental
yeah.
social reform. And then you go in and look exactly what you're talking about in the movie, where we still have what seems like the Reform Party completely in bed with the status quo. How concerned are you of this not just being bad politics, but disillusioning this generation that was really poised to make a move?
Oh, it's probably my number one concern, and I want to, and I've said this over and over, and I say it publicly to Barack Obama, that you inspired so many people, so many young people, to get involved in our political system. These young people who are always talked about as being apathetic and uninterested, they got interested. You got them interested, Barack Obama. And if you let them down, if you are just more of the same, this will have devastating consequences, because it'll turn this youthful optimism to cynicism very quickly. And if you have another whole generation of cynics coming up who totally distrust the process, and then more than half of them decide to check out and not even bother to vote anymore, you will have done great damage to the process. I hope he knows that. I hope he knows that his actions really go far beyond just this bill or that bill. It has a lot to do with whether or not people who are filled with so much hope right now have those hopes dashed. And if they are dashed, they will sink, and he will sink with them.
Now, in the interest of battling cynicism, who are some of the national political figures that you've gotten to know or followed that inspire you, that you think really stand for something and have integrity?
When you say political figures, do you mean politicians? Or?
Basically, people in the public life who are really making a stand, either as in elected office or organizing one way or another. But, I mean, because to battle cynicism, there should be here are some people really doing it right.
Well, I would say the majority of the Congressional Black Caucus have completely figured out what needs to happen here. And they're a real voice, a real conscience in the Congress. And I wish the media would turn to them more and listen to them, because we would have alternate voices on the air if we heard more from them.
Mm-hmm.
There are members of Congress that people probably don't know, and one of them I have in my film. I never really knew who she was. Her name is Marcy Kaptur. She's the congresswoman from Toledo, Ohio.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you see her in this film? I mean, she essentially she calls the people on Wall Street criminals. She says that, you know, it's their job as members of Congress to defend the country from all enemies, foreign and domestic. I mean, she's a real firebrand and pulls no punches. She's served on the banking committee for years, so she's seen it all. Representative Weiner from Brooklyn,
mm-hmm.
who will not give up on single payer and is pushing and leading the fight and not afraid to stand up and tell the administration that they've got to do the right thing here. And there are a number of good people, and you know, you often don't see them in the media, but they're there.
Michael Moore, it's been such a pleasure talking with you today, and thank you for taking this time to join us here in Media Matters. I'd love to get you back for a full hour when the dust clears on all your promotion and you've got a little downtime, so we could have callers call in. Is that something you could do?
I'd love to do that sometime, absolutely.
Yeah, well, we'll wait till you've won the Oscar this year. And
please. I'll be happy if people just start get active here and get involved and do not allow these few Democrats who are getting in the way of universal health care to stop what needs to happen.
Thanks so much for those words. Michael Moore, our guest today on Media Matters, maker
thanks,
of the brand new film, Capitalism, a Love Story, out this weekend all over the country. Okay, thanks a lot, Michael, and have a great time promoting the film.
Thank you. Thank
all
you
right.
very much.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Thank you. Greetings. Welcome back to part two of Media Matters Today. Now we're back live on this Sunday, October 11th, 2009. You just heard the interview I recorded. I'm Bob McChesney, that I recorded with Michael Moore about 9 days ago before having a chance to see Capitalism Lovester. I've since seen it and wish I had had a chance to interview him after that, but we were fortunate to get him when we did. Now we have the second part of our show, and we're very fortunate to have another documentary filmmaker with us live on the line. Our guest is Sue Wilson, who has produced the new film Broadcast Blues, which I have had the privilege of seeing. She is the Emmy Award-winning broadcast journalist who's done a lot of investigative work in California for stations in Los Angeles and Sacramento. She's broken a number of major stories on public health and public interest, and it's a real honor to have her join us live on the air. Welcome to Media Matters, Sue Wilson. Okay, Sue? Apparently, connection is not exactly... Hello? Hello, Sue.
There we are.
Okay, great. Good to hear your voice, and welcome to Media Matters.
Thank you so much.
Well, first of all, you have a very impressive resume as a working journalist and television journalism over the past two decades. And before we talk about your film Broadcast Blues, what led you out of being a television journalist in Sacramento and Los Angeles to being a documentary filmmaker?
Well, of course, it was a long road, but it really started one day when I worked for a television station who told me that I should spin the coverage of a murder trial to make the guy who was on trial look guilty. And I thought that that was the worst thing I'd ever heard, that I don't think it's the media's job to be interfering with the system of justice. And it created an earthquake of an attitude shift in my mind, which that's many years ago, but it's led me down this path.
And you have been, this film, Broadcast Blues, is really a searing indictment of the state of journalism, especially broadcast journalism in the United States. If you had to summarize it for a listener, why you did the film and what it argues in a nutshell, what would you say?
I would say that there have been policies which have been changed since the 80s, which have adversely affected the news and information and even our public safety. And that it comes back to policies, and it comes back to a conversation I had with you a few years ago, because I interviewed you, you're in the film, and I remember that we talked about that a light bulb went on when people realized that this wasn't in the Constitution, this wasn't like something that came down from God that said media must be this way. The policies, especially the 1996 Telecommunications Act, decimated radio. It led us to this culture that we have today of shouting rather than conversing. And my message is, these are government policies, and we, the people, own this government, and we, the people, can get those policies changed back into something that works better for all of us if we only stand together and start shouting.
Our guest, Sue Wilson, who made the new documentary, Broadcast Blues. If you want to call in and have a question or comment for Sue Wilson, the number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. And Sue Wilson, if folks want to learn more about the documentary or find out how they can see it, where should they go on the web?
Well, first of all, this is a public interest picture. Public Interest Pictures has done many public interest-oriented documentaries, most recently Hacking Democracy, about the electronic voting machines that have no paper trail. It's their picture, but the website is www.broadcastblues.tv, or you can just Google Broadcast Blues and it should come up for you.
You know, one of the themes you talk about, Sue Wilson, in the film is talk radio. I think you've already mentioned it here because it is such an important phenomenon in our political culture. And the statistics that you cite demonstrate that, 90% of talk radio programs on commercial stations, or maybe all stations in the United States, have a fairly strong conservative or right-wing perspective and very supportive of the Republicans and oftentimes extremely critical of the Democratic Party. And I was wondering, in view of the changes in the last two elections, where the Democrats have won, you know, resounding victories in two consecutive congressional elections, which hasn't been done by a major party to such an extent since the Depression and the New Deal, have we seen the businesses that own radio stations around the country sort of stick their finger in the air and say, hey, maybe people are interested in a different political perspective? and we'll get more liberal talk radio or Democratic talk radio. And I ask you that, let me preface it, because in the 90s and during the first administration of George W. Bush, we were often told the reason why all these shows are conservatives is because that's what the American people want. But clearly, the American people who vote don't want that. Are the owners of these stations coming around and giving a broader range of viewpoints?
Gee, wouldn't that be nice if the owners of radio stations actually reflected the makeup of America? No. And in fact, if anything, the radio stations are getting more and more right-wing. You know, one of the stories I tell in the film is going to the Ed Schultz show. Ed, of course, is the most popular progressive radio host in the country. He now has a program on MSNBC. But his very popular, higher-rated radio program has been taken off the air in many, many stations across the country. And, in fact, this has been true ever since the 2006 election. So we start talking about elections and how they have swung toward the Democrats, yet that is when they started to take progressive stations off the air. And let me be clear, these are progressive stations where they were getting good ratings, and they've been taken off the air anyway and replaced with shows that are getting less than half of the ratings the progressives got. So there clearly is something else. There's a different dynamic going on here than, oh, let's just give the people what they want. Let's sell the advertisers the audience that they want, which is more what it really is. Let's sell the advertisers. Let's not serve the public. Let me say this, too, because I think it's so important. Michael Moore just talked about Democrats need to get off of the bench and start shouting. And I agree with that. But you got to realize the right wing has an enormous cheerleading squad that is aided by thousands of AM stations all across this United States, that is also aided by cable TV. But primarily, they've got cheerleaders on the radio all over the country saying, get out for these town halls, get out for these tea parties. We've got this little bitty voice. Maybe it's Michael Moore, who's the biggest voice because he's the biggest documentarian, or maybe it's Bob McChesney at WILL in Chicago. But comparatively, the voice is very small, telling progressives to get off the bench. There's no cheerleader on our side.
Yeah, that's a good point, Sue Wilson, that a lot of people, most Americans only live in one town. They're not traveling around all the time. But in almost every community in the United States, there are sort of local Limbaughs and local savages sort of plying their trade. And there's really a farm system of conservative talk hosts. And it seems like the way you get to the top now is to be like a Michael Savage or Glenn Beck, who sort of is more outrageous than anyone else around you.
Yeah, and you've got to ask yourself why that is. Is it just for the sake of being outrageous, or what's the real motivation behind what isn't just outrage, but, you know, flat-out lies, misinformation, and even inciting violence? I mean, that's where you really have to draw the line. So far, the federal government hasn't been willing to draw that line. It's an interesting conundrum.
Sue Wilson, another theme you talk about in your new documentary, Broadcast Blues, is in a, you know, beyond just the fact that we have a bias on the talk radio spectrum towards the political right, a heavy bias all over the country, is the point that we're seeing the disintegration and elimination of actual journalism on radio and television stations all across the country, stations that once actually did quite a bit of journalism.
Yeah, it's a terrible thing to witness journalists who, I think it's because the corporate line has gotten so much stronger over the past 20 years, and where journalists are so much more subject now to a corporate-held monolithic kind of structure within their own newsroom, as opposed to the local ownership that we once had in newsrooms. I'm going to say that localism is really the key to better journalism, because you don't, when you have a local ownership, you don't have a big corporation that has its own agenda that they are trying to either push or keep away. In the case of talk radio, there's an agenda which is being pushed. In the case of journalism, there are messages that corporations clearly do not want people to know about. I cover this in the film, and it's an older story, but it's so relevant. It's the story of the two reporters, Jane Akrey and Steve Wilson, out of WTBC in Tampa Bay, Florida. Now, these investigative reporters discovered that bovine growth hormone was being injected into cattle, and that that growth hormone had strong indicators that it caused cancer in human beings when people would drink the milk. Pretty important story. And they did this under the full cooperation of the local Fox News station, WTBT, until Monsanto threatened Roger Ailes at the top corporation and said, no, we're going to sue you if this story hits the air. Well, they tried to get the reporters to alter the story so much that it didn't tell the truth anymore. The reporters wouldn't do it. They got fired. They filed a whistleblower suit, and they won. They won, and they had to prove, in order to win, that Fox News deliberately engaged in news distortion, that they deliberately tried to distort this news. They won that case, but then Fox News goes back and says, well, this is in the appeals court, well, yes, it's true that there's an FCC policy that we should not distort the news, but there's actually no law against distorting the news, so therefore we should win this case. And guess what they did? The court said, you're right, no law against lying to the public.
Our guest, Sue Wilson, maker of the brand new film Broadcast Blues. If you'd like to call in to talk to her about her film, the number here at WILL is 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Sue, I do have to point out that you called WILL's hometown Chicago. We're based in Champaign-Urbana. Chicago is actually a suburb of ours.
My apologies.
Quite okay. You know, one of the characters in your film, or one of the experts in your film is a better way to put it. In fact, he's not a character at all, is Mark Lloyd, who currently has a job at the Federal Communications Commission and has done a lot of work on localism and political bias and radio and the service to local communities of both radio and television stations. And Mark Lloyd, as you know, has been under phenomenal attack by Glenn Beck and by the political right to sort of, you know, question his legitimacy working on the administration. And, you know, Mark Lloyd in your film is an authority on this issue. So there's sort of cognitive dissonance. If someone watches Glenn Beck, you expect to see him to be sort of a raving lunatic. And one watches your film, he's sort of a distinguished expert. What's the real Mark Lloyd?
Well, I think that Mark Lloyd is clearly a distinguished expert and that he is clearly someone who has spent much of his life looking at these issues. I think, you know, there's been conversations and the media reform community has had them, and there are many people who think that this is a brand of racism. I have to be sensitive to that. Personally, I don't think that's what this is. The right wing, and especially radio people, and Glenn Beck is a radio person also. He's got 300 or 400 stations that he broadcasts on the radio. They have been, for years, Sean Hannity, Rush Limbaugh, they've been screaming on their radio programs about the Fairness Doctrine, that if there's a Democratic administration, they're going to bring back the Fairness Doctrine. Now, they've been screaming about this for 2 years while nobody was talking about the Fairness Doctrine. Democrats haven't brought that up in ages.
And Sue, can I ask you just to explain what the Fairness Doctrine is for some of our listeners who might not be familiar with it?
Well, the Fairness Doctrine was instituted, I believe, in 1949. It was shortly after World War II. We had come through a war where we saw the power of propaganda on the radio via Tokyo Rose. And so the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission, instituted a rule that had to do with giving opposing viewpoints. A radio station, if there's going to be a controversial issue, that they must air opposing viewpoints. Well, that rule went on for many years, and there were problems with that rule because each political party tried to use it to bludgeon the other. But it did some good things. It not only gave some equal time, it also, we had community programming at one time. Every TV station was required to put on local programs that served its community. that went away when the Fairness Doctrine went away. Also, once upon a time, if I were going to have one candidate on for political office, I'd have to have all the candidates on for political office. And this is something my boss at the time said, you know, we've got 10 candidates, we have two that were really viable, and we have to put on the crazy eight in order to put them all on the air. At the same time, when we had that system, the crazy eight, maybe there'd be somebody who would emerge from that that wasn't so crazy after all, and they didn't have to go through a process where they had to raise $250,000 to run for the local congressional seat. They actually got a little bit of time to put their viewpoint on the air. Okay, fast forward to the Reagan administration. Ronald Reagan's administration said, we're not going to enforce the Fairness Doctrine anymore. And at that point, Trent Lott, Newt Gingrich, many other Republicans joined with Democrats and said, no, we think this is important. We think we should bring the Fairness Doctrine back. Reagan vetoed that legislation. This whole coalition of Republicans and Democrats again tried to bring the Fairness Doctrine back under George Herbert Walker Bush. Bush also vetoed that legislation. Now, we're a few years down the road, and there is today pretty much an agreement that the Fairness Doctrine really got into content. It's very, very difficult for the government to monitor speech on the radio. So there has been a different tack, and that tack, well, and it came out as soon as President Obama became president, as soon as he was inaugurated, on his technology page, he cited three goals with regard to media. Number one is defining public interest standards. Remember, the airwaves are supposed to serve the public interest. Right now, they're really not. But that was number one. Number two was to diversify media ownership, because right now, only 8% of women and minorities own any of these airwaves. And number three was to restore localism. Well, back to your question about Mark Lloyd. You've got Glenn Beck now attacking Mark Lloyd. Why? They are trying to create a boogeyman out of the word localism. They have been on the airwaves. In fact, I have an article I wrote. You can find it on my blog called Save Talk Radio, really. Right now, there are groups across the country who have quietly put together an army of 550,000 people to make sure that localism cannot be restored to the airwaves. Somehow, they've been pushing this line that if localism comes around, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh will have to go away. It really doesn't make a lot of sense, but they're selling a lot of people on this crazy idea.
And Sue Wilson, what exactly do you think people can do if they're concerned about the state of broadcast news, about what's going on with commercial radio, talk shows? You're interested in media policy reform. What are the measures that you would recommend that people pursue?
Well, first of all, we have to make media an issue. For example, health care is obviously a big issue in this country. And why is it an issue? Because the people rose up and screamed and yelled about it long enough to where the politicians finally started to pay attention and say, yes, now is the time. We haven't done much of that since 2003 when 3 million Americans rose up to stop further media consolidation. So number one, make media an issue. How do you do that? Well, through all of the quote, normal avenues that we would take, calling our congressmen, emailing our senators, writing letters to the editor of the local newspapers. Local newspapers are typically more willing to have this conversation than local broadcasters are, because the broadcasters are owned not locally but by our bigger corporations, and they're reticent to point a finger at themselves.
Our guest today, Sue Wilson, who made the new documentary, Broadcast Blues. You can go to broadcastblues.tv to learn more about it. And Sue Wilson, you write for the Huffington Post, if I'm not mistaken?
I do from time to time.
From time to time. And where else can people find your work on the web?
Well, I have been posting most of my latest work on my own website, which is suewilsonreports.com. I have been posting on the Brad blog, and I have been posting on Buzzflash.
And, you know, as you look at the situation here with your film, how are you doing, faring with getting theaters to carry it, with getting it distributed? You know, Michael Moore, you know, I think is at one end of the spectrum where he's has built up a following and gets airings in a way that few documentary filmmakers, regardless of their political views, have ever had before. I suspect you're much more in with the rest of the pack. what is it like to make a film like you've made, which is really an outstanding and professional film, to get it so people will see it?
Well, thank you for that compliment. You know, it is interesting because Michael Moore is kind of like this bullet train that's speeding across the country, and I'm the little engine that could. it's very difficult. And when I bring this, first of all, film festivals, I've gotten into just a couple of film festivals.
And you've done well at them, haven't you?
I have. We've won an award in our first. We just went to Kansas where we sold out the house. And they were so impressed that they squeezed us into the Hot Springs Documentary Film Festival this October 22nd. You were supposed to have applied by last May, and I did not. But on the strength of what they saw in Kansas, they said, no, you're going to this big show. We have to put you there. So people like the film. And I want to say this, too. I didn't make this film for the media reform crowd. The media reform community understands these issues very, very well. I made this film for people who don't know anything about media reform and who look at this, but they know there's something wrong. They know there's something really, really wrong with the media. So, yes, when people, when real people see this film, both conservatives and liberals come out of the theater going, wow, I learned something. This is amazing. I'm energized. I'm inspired. How can I do more? However, this really is the movie the media does not want you to see. Even film festivals, who are, you know, mostly their job is to try to feed the corporate cable TV slots or that kind of thing, you know, they're not terribly interested because the guy who runs my website said that I am pounding the stake into the vampire's heart.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do I have the typical documentarian problems of how do you get people to see the film, but I have a film that really a lot of people would like to keep away from the public if they possibly could.
And I saw the anecdote somewhere about the theme music you were going to use for the film. You were going to use Bruce Springsteen's song, My Hometown.
Well, I was actually going to use that. I've got a wonderful story about the Minot, North Dakota ammonia spill several years ago and how because Clear Channel owned all six commercial stations in town, they weren't able to get the word out. There was one broken telephone line, which meant nobody could reach six different radio stations to tell people what to do in a really severe disaster. I was going to use Your Hometown during that segment. And we had the paperwork signed. I mean, this was a deal that we had with Bruce Springsteen. Only then his representative called my music guy, and they said, oops, guess what? Bruce is going on concert tour, and we realized that if we give you the rights to use Your Hometown for this film, we are severely going to make Clear Channel mad. And if we make Clear Channel mad, they won't play us on the radio, and they won't give us this concert tour. Because Clear Channel not only owns almost all the country's radio stations, but they own almost all the country's concert venues. This goes way beyond news and politics. So, okay, fast forward. We can't use Your Hometown. Now we've got a theme song. My co-producer, Harry Cowan, and my best husband, he wrote this theme song. But trust me, you wouldn't want him or me to be performing this thing. So we called some professional musicians that we knew in Nashville and said, can you record this for us? And they looked at it and they said, well, we could, only we'd have to do this anonymously because if Clear Channel found out, they'd destroy our careers. So we have put together the anonymous Don't Tell Clear Channel band to record the theme song. And if you want the theme song, you can go to our website. You can download the theme song for free. As to who's in the band, well, keep guessing.
You know, it's really quite an extraordinary statement that I don't know who's in the band. I'm not going to ask because I respect their privacy, but that a performer of the stature of a Bruce Springsteen is intimidated by the power of a Clear Channel the monopoly power they have in the marketplace. One can only imagine what any other musician in this country could possibly, you know, what courage they would have to mount a challenge against a Clear Channel and what the effects of media monopoly are. Sue Wilson, one other question I do want to get to that I often hear when discussions of broadcast news and bias and limitations of commercial broadcasting raised, which is the argument that all of this is really passé or soon to be passé because of the rise of the internet and the blogosphere. Traditional concerns about the importance and role of old-fashioned AM and FM radio and television and even cable are soon going the way of the dodo. And they'd say, look at you yourself, Sue Wilson. Here you are. You're all over the internet. You've got websites. You're blogging. That's where the future is. And in that world, the Rush Limbaughs don't dominate. What do you think of that?
I think we have to look at how many years from now will it be before we get into our car and we turn on something else besides the radio.
Spoken like a Californian.
That's right. You know, many people spend their time in their cars listening to the radio. The most recent Pew report says that 21% of the people say that they get their news from radio. So I just question how long it's going to be before those numbers really change. Now, at some point, will they change? Yeah. But how many years, how many election cycles is it going to be before that dynamic changes? You know, they're telling me in terms of television that as long as they get the broadband worked out, which they're working on very hard right now, that you know, within maybe 10 years, we will switch on our television sets. And, yeah, it'll be pretty much like switching on your computer. You'll be able to choose from, you know, all these different online sites. I don't see that happening for radio. I don't see that happening for a very, very long time. And that's why radio, I think, is the most important battle. Radio is specifically subject to the 1996 Telecommunications Act. I mean, shoot, once upon a time in this country, one owner could have six radio stations, 3 a.m., 3 f.m., and that was across the entire country. Because of the 96 Telecommunications Act, one owner can now own as many stations across the country as they can get their hands on, and up to eight in one single market. It has completely changed the dynamic of radio, of our discourse. It's to me, the 96 Telecommunications Act is terribly important, and radio remains important on my agenda anyway.
It seems that in the past couple of years, two phenomena have taken place with commercial radio broadcasting ownership. One is we've seen the rise of the hedge fund crowd, these equity, private equity groups gobbling up stations. And on the in the other hand, we're seeing a lot of stations for sale as group companies like Clear Channel are unloading their less profitable units. Am I accurate in these appraisals, or is that what's going on?
Yeah, it's absolutely true. And the value of Clear Channel has plummeted in recent years. They, you know, their demise may be the best thing that happens. We'll see.
How about these? Are you excited when you see these private equity groups come in and hedge funds and buy up the radio stations?
It goes back to the idea of localism. It goes back to the idea of, wouldn't it be nice if at least a number of local stations could be in local control? I've just had a conversation. I live in a little place called Amador County. There's like 30,000 people that live in Amador County. So, yes, there is rural America in California. And their little local station that was on the air for many, many years got sold to a Spanish-language station which now services Stockton. Well, Stockton's about 60 miles away. Amador County has very, very few Spanish-speaking people. And they're very upset that they've lost their local ability to tell people about fire dangers and what's going on.
On that note, unfortunately, Sue Wilson, I hear the bantering of the background. That means they want to clear me out of the studio. Sue Wilson, producer, director, creator of Broadcast Blues, thank you very much for joining us today on Media Matters.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
I'm Bob McChesney, and I want to thank Kyle Kroha for working the board, Melissa Trentz for being my producer. And I want to remind all listeners, next week, starting at 1, from 1 to 3, will be a two-hour version of Media Matters with John Nichols and a cast of four others on the air with us. It'll be our pledge drive week. It's going to be a great show. Make sure to join us again in 167 hours. Thank you all, and have a great week.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, today will be mostly sunny and cool with a high reaching 51 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy skies with a low of 36. Monday, mostly cloudy with a high of 61. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 42. And Tuesday brings partly sunny skies with a high of 58 degrees. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9.